Baseball fans, think you know who's hitting a homer today? Well, FanDuel is giving you a free chance to call your shot with daily dingers. Joining the action is easy. Just make your free pick on who's hitting a home run in their game, and if you're right, you'll get a profit boost to use on your next bet for a chance at extra winnings. You've got nothing to lose and a lot to gain. And don't forget, you can make a free pick every day during the MLB season. It's just another reason why FanDuel is the home for home runs. So, are you ready to play your game today? Join all the action at FanDuel.com/podcast. That's FanDuel.com/podcast to play daily dingers and make your free pick on who's hitting a homer. Play ball and swing for the fences on FanDuel, an official partner of the MLB.
Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. A bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hello and welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar Johnson. And last time around, we had a first time guest in JM Hines. This time around, we have about as opposite from that as you can get in the former co-host of this year podcast, Tyler Metcalf. Metcalf, how are you doing this fine afternoon?
Nick, I'm fantastic. Always a pleasure to talk hoops and anything else with you. So excited to be back on and thrilled for, very, very excited for this season, both college and NBA.
And one of the players who we were both thrilled about last season was the subject of your most recent article over at No Ceilings NBA, talking about Neat Clifford. And so I think I know the answer, but just, you know, sort of for the sake of discussion here, what was it that led you to write about Neek for this article at this point in the season?
He's really good.
Well, yeah, okay, fine. What else?
So, you know, I like writing about happy things, about good things, and he made it really easy. And he was kind of someone that I really enjoyed last year. I thought there's a very clearly defined kind of 3-and-D role with him. You know, Corey had an awesome film breakdown with him over at the No Ceilings YouTube channel. Go check it out. Shameless plug.
When are your plugs shameful? I got
always. I had a first round grade on him last year, you know, end of first, early second, that kind of range. And I was really surprised when he not only kind of decided to withdraw from the draft, but then just flat out returned to Colorado State instead of transferring to, you know, a power conference or something like that. So with those guys, it's always like, okay, was the shooting improvement last year a fluke? Was the kind of on-ball creation and playmaking against Virginia in the tournament, was that just a one-off, or was that something that we're really building on going forward into this season? And so far, you know, it's obviously still early, caveats aside, it looks like it's real tangible growth in areas that really matter for him going forward.
So we'll get into the next part in a moment, but I actually did want to stick with something you just said for a moment here. So I was a bit later to the Neat Clifford train than some of the No Ceilings people, but by the time we got to the end of last year, I had him basically exactly the same spot you just mentioned. I think I had him like 32nd or something like that, like right at the top of the second round. But the part that interests me is that you were surprised that he, you know, returned to Colorado State specifically, because for me, I had almost the sort of opposite idea of this is a guy who, you know, eventually earned a starting spot for Colorado in the Pac-12, but, you know, he didn't have that much of, you know, he wasn't the focus of the offense, even though he started most of the games in his junior year. He averaged under 6 points a game, right? He was someone who was not going to get the sort of on-ball reps that led to him breaking out last year at Colorado State. And it's one of those debates that, you know, we sort of constantly weigh in our minds as draft evaluators. And, you know, Maxwell does this most often in terms of written content at No Ceilings of, you know, guys who are going to potentially up transfer. And in some cases, you know, that's like Dalton Connect, right? That's a great thing. You know, all of a sudden he does exactly the same thing, except on a much higher profile team. And, you know, he ends up going 17th. And that was later than many people expected, as opposed to where he was at the year before, where, you know, if he'd been late in the first round, you know, that would have been seen as, you know, pretty decent from where he'd been playing previously, right? With Neek, it's like, is it really necessarily better for someone like him who had such a breakout year last year in a slightly smaller pond to try and quote unquote up transfer? Because we've seen him in the Pac-12 already, right? And, you know, it wasn't like he was a bad player. You know, he was a starter for that Colorado team his junior year, but he didn't get to show a lot of what he showed last year that led to him being someone who, again, did not start last year anywhere near my top 100, much less my top 60, and was, you know, in that late first, early second range by the end of the year, and is right about there this year too.
Yeah, and I guess the biggest reason I was kind of surprised was because I, you know, with a lot of these guys where they kind of, they're the, you know, the quote unquote the guy at a mid-major, it's typically because they're the on-ball creator. They are the, it's more of a heliocentric model where they have a massive usage. They create everything for everyone else. They're creating their own shots. They're spotting up, you know, they're doing anything and everything basically that they want. And that's never the vibe or kind of hope that I've gotten from Neek Clifford's game. That's not what he's best at. And with specifically Isaiah Stevens leaving and going to the pros last year, it's like, okay, what is this going to look like now with Neek Clifford kind of being the guy and without that primary on-ball creator like he had with Isaiah Stevens? Because Stevens was an incredible college player, really fun summer league, but that's a ton of usage and on-ball creation responsibility to be vacated. And I never thought of Neek's game kind of filling that role, where I love how he's improved. We'll get into all that stuff, but even the areas that he's improving, he's not filling that role, which I think is really, really encouraging. On one hand, would it have been cool if he just came out as like this point forward and had a usage of 30 and was just dominating possessions? I mean, maybe. But also when we talk about that translating to the next level and who he is as a player, who he'll be asked to be as a role player going forward, it would be totally irrelevant growth, because it would be shocking if he's ever, ever asked to do that kind of stuff going forward.
So that actually is a perfect way to transition into the sort of first major point that I wanted to hit after, you know, all of our intro stuff. And it's funny because Jam and I had basically the same conversation last week about Robert Hinton of, okay, you know, this guy's averaging 25 points a game in the early going. How much of that is going to be relevant at all to his NBA role? And so I'm just going to quote you here from the piece, because you said it a lot better than I could. When players return to school and show improvement, it's important to put those improvements in a proper context for what their NBA role is most likely to be. One of the biggest struggles is identifying meaningful skill and tendency improvements versus simple increases in usage. If a 3-and-D wing continues to post similar efficiency, playmaking, and tendency numbers as the year before, but on higher volume, then were there really any improvements made outside of the raw box score numbers? Conversely, if that archetype of player continues to operate in a similar role, but has diversified their shot selection, expanded their passing repertoire, and shifted their play type tendency, then we can start to identify tangible improvements. This latter bucket is where Clifford looks to be falling into so far this season. And, you know, I went through all of that because I think that's really sort of the crux of the argument here when we're talking about this kind of player, right? You know, is there a world in which Neek Clifford becomes an all-NBA guy averaging 30 points a game? I don't think that's particularly likely. Like, you know, again, with all of the, you know, we call ourselves no ceilings, right? We can't say, hey, you know, there's an upper limit to what Neek Clifford could be. But, you know, if we're talking outside of like 99.9th percentile outcomes, then the question there is, okay, you know, what is he going to potentially prove this year at Colorado State that will, you know, sort of solidify his NBA future? And it's exactly what you just mentioned, right? You know, he's going to have more ball handling opportunities with Isaiah Stevens moving on, but what can he show in that sort of increased opportunity, increased usage that will be parlayed into the next level, as opposed to just, hey, this Colorado State team has, you know, one high level prospect and the rest of the team is, you know, not on the same level as Neek, so why don't we just get him the ball every single time, right? You know, if that's sort of the argument that you're going through, then it's not, you know, like him taking a few more touches from Jalen Lake is not going to be the determinant of his NBA future.
Right. And, you know, His usage, I think, is up just a little bit this year, but it's right around like 21, 22, which is a really reasonable level, especially for an upperclassman at a mid-major who's been as productive and kind of popular as he is. But then we look at the, you know, kind of play type tendencies, and yeah, spot up is still his number one, but the frequency's down a couple percentage points. And okay, so where is that kind of filled out elsewhere? And it's in transition. It's as the pick and roll ball handler. It's as cuts. It's running off of screens. And it's great that all those things are up, and specifically with the pick and roll ball handling. But when you actually watch the film, it's the ways in which he's getting into those situations that is really encouraging and really tangible and translatable to the next level. Because it's not like all of his pick and roll possessions aren't, all right, inbound the ball, I'm going to bring it up and initiate the offense. Here we go. Clear out, you know, empty corner, yeah, pick and roll. Let's go. It's Neek's show to run. It's more so fluid ball movement in the flow of the offense. Ball swings to him on the second side, and now he's running that second side pick and roll, or he's cutting, he's relocating, he's setting an off ball screen. He's going into a DHO. Now nothing's there. Now he's resetting. Now he's running a pick and roll late in the shot clock and either getting to the rim, getting to a spot in the mid range, or kind of distributing for other people. So it's this improvement in ball skills with his handle, with his passing, his ability to attack closeouts. When he gets run off the line, is he useless anymore? No. Like, he has a lot of different ways that he can attack a defense, kind of manipulate their momentum, manipulate their rotations. And that's the type of stuff that we constantly see off-ball wings have to do in the NBA, because the windows are so finite. And if you are just a spot-up shooter, you're toast. You're never going to get real serious minutes. You might get some opportunities, but unless you can consistently attack a closeout or do something else, you're just going to kind of fall out of the rotation. And I think what Neek is showing us this year is that all of those skills are really building on each other and kind of coming to fruition.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, it's one of those things. I sort of go back to the well with this example all the time because it's the one that sort of confounded me the most when it happened and is the most explanatory in hindsight of, man, could Troy Daniels shoot, but he couldn't do anything else. And he fell out of the league quickly because he couldn't do anything else. And that's, I think, you know, you made this distinction, and I think it's the absolutely most important distinction to make of, the idea here is not, you know, okay, can Neek Clifford build up the skill set needed to monopolize the offense, right? It's not that. The question is, when the ball goes his way, what's he going to do with it, right? You know, if the defense is forcing him off the three-point line, can he do something else? Can he, you know, pass the ball off to the next guy, right? Make a quick decision. Can he attack that closeout if the defender leaves more room for him to attack than for him to create passing opportunities for others, right? The question is not, okay, is this someone who we can, you know, give the ball to, you know, every time down the floor for, you know, 5-6 possessions in a row, right? The main question is, given that, again, other than the most pie in the sky outcome, he's not going to be the number one option offensively, or honestly, probably even the number two option offensively, right? Then the question is, what else can he do to continue to bind an offense together, you know, both, especially as you mentioned, you know, the spot up stuff, the off ball stuff, that's, you know, okay, he's got that, right? But the question is, when the ball swings his way and he has to do something, what can he do?
Yeah, and I think when I wrote the piece, I think he was shooting like 50% from three. That I think he's down to like 45% right now. Yeah. Obviously, you know, no one ever expected that 50% to maintain throughout the year. It'd be cool if he does. but also, like, if the only change in his game this year was that he shoots 48% on spot up jumpers all year, and like that's all that changed in his game, I'm not sure I would really get that much more excited about it. And a little bit, because it's like, all right, cool. The shooting improvement looks to be very real and, you know, very lethal corner option plus the defense. Cool. That's a solid ninth, 10th man in a rotation now. But if defenders just kind of kept running him off his spot, and he would take one dribble and kick it out to someone else to reset the offense. And it's like, all right, you're incredibly easy to defend now, because we can really help off hard on rollers, leave you alone in the corner, and just close out hard and run you off your spot, because we know that once we do that, you're toast. You're not going to do anything. You're not going to reset the offense. You're not going to attack the mid-range, attack the rim, you know, knock down a sidestep or step back three. But those are the things he's doing now. And even though, you know, I don't expect the insane shooting numbers to kind of maintain all year, they're going to come down. That's fine. But the fact that there's so much more variety and patience and effectiveness and diversity and just his overall approach to the offense and that off-ball creation role, whether it's his movement or, you know, implementing these improved ball skills, it's really, really important for an off-ball wing. And it takes you from being that ninth, tenth man to, you know, one day at his peak, maybe fringe starter, you know, number 6-7 guy in a rotation instead.
Yeah, and, you know, especially given that both of the NBA teams that we're fans of currently run very strict 8-man rotations, yeah, and not that much more, right? It's like, you know, having that extra bit of depth piece can be very helpful when Keegan Murray is asked to play 49 minutes for the 17th night in a row. But, you know, with Clifford, I think there's two key points to note with the shooting, and you note both of them early in the piece. You know, again, some of the numbers in the piece, if you read Metcalf's article, if you hadn't read it before listening to this, why? But, you know, second of all, if you do read it now, those numbers will be off, because we went from a completely insignificant sample size of 3 games to a thoroughly proven sample size of 4 games, right? But you know, with the shooting, I think there are two key points with Neek specifically. And the first one is, as you mentioned, I'm going to quote you again, the biggest concern was the validity of his shooting improvement, because this is a guy that prior to last season, you know, he had shot 34% from 3-point range, yeah, over his 3 years at Colorado, right? And then all of a sudden last year, he shoots a higher volume than he ever has before, and he knocks him down at a 38% clip. And I, you know, going back to the well of one of my favorite comparisons here, of what I've called the Derek Williams principle of anybody, because of the sample sizes of 3-point shooting, yeah, you know, especially if you're taking 3 a game, right? Anybody can have one season where they go on a heater. And if you sort of look at those numbers out of context, then you can say, wow, Derek Williams is, you know, a 50% 3-point shooter because he made like 37 of 70 or whatever it was that 1 year at Arizona, right? It's one of those things where 3-point shooting sample sizes, you know, even a full NBA season is often not enough to stabilize. I mean, this is, you know, this is one of those things where I think the main reason for the decline was for separate reasons. But if you look at Marco Bellinelli's career numbers, you know, 37%, 37%, 37%, 37%. His 1 year in Sacramento, he shoots like 30%, right? It's one of those things where, you know, you look at pretty much, other than the elite of the elite shooters, basically everybody's going to have 1 year in their sample size where it looks a lot different from the rest of their career. And if it's a positive outlier, then you have to look at it with a lot more skepticism than, you know, say if Neek's shooting numbers had been flipped and, you know, his junior year at Colorado, he'd shot 38% from 3-point range. And then last year he'd shot 28% from 3-point range. You look at things a lot differently, right? But if we're talking about, you know, sort of tracking shooting improvement, the fact that he's both upped his volume from 3-point range, you know, in the early going, and also knocked them down at a clip that at least, you know, again, do we think the 50% or 47% is going to sustain all season? Not necessarily, but, you know, it's a lot better than starting off the season 0-for-15 from three, right? If you're trying to sort of track the improvement there.
Yeah, that's always the tricky part of looking at just raw shooting numbers, where it's like, if you only look at a percentage, it can tell you basically whatever you want it to. Sure. Like, over the last couple of years in the NBA, two off-ball wings who, if you just look at the box score, you're like, God, these guys have turned into really good shooters, and Isaac Okoro and Christian Brown, but the defense doesn't treat them like shooters. They don't care if they shoot it, because it's, what, 2 to 3.5 attempts a game throughout a whole season, and it's like, all right, there are bigger fish to fry from a defensive perspective, and they know that it's like, all right, when the ball swings to you, are you going to shoot it? Maybe. Do we care if you do? No. In fact, for us, it's the better option if you do. So, because they know they're only taking a couple of them a game, so they don't have to treat them like real shooters. And that's kind of how Clifford was last year with, I think it was around like two or three attempts a game. The percentage increase was great, but it's like, all right, like, you're not really a shooter. And when the ball would swing to you, it's like, all right, cool. Sometimes it's great when you make a quick decision and get off of it and make that extra pass. But other times it's like, you got 10 feet of space. You let it fly. Like, you got to let it shoot. And that's what he's starting to do this year, where the volume's up, the decision-making is up, the processing speed is up, and the shooting improvement, at least from a percentage standpoint, is also up for now. So it's about getting that volume up, getting more comfortable and confident with, when that ball swings to me, I know I'm the best option to let it fly here. And doing that more and more obviously gets in more reps to kind of figure out the shooting mechanics and shooting improvements. But then it also just forces the defense to be like, oh, shit, I got to scramble. I got to close out on this guy. Like, I got to get there. And then once they start finally doing that, that's when all of those opportunities to attack closeouts, make the extra pass, you know, initiate that second side DHO pick and roll, something like that. That's when those all really elevate and become even so much more valuable. But they only kind of come to fruition if you're willing to shoot it.
Well, and that sort of goes back to, you know, the point we were making earlier, right? Of, for him at Colorado State this year, you know, him working the clock down and dribbling into an 18-foot pull-up is not something that's, you know, going to upset the coach all that much, right? But, you know, if he's in an NBA context, then he's the eighth man and he continues to hesitate and pass up open looks at the three-point line, that's a bit more of a problem, right? Because those are the shots that he's expected to take, as opposed to, you know, he has a lot more freedom at Colorado State than presumably he will have at the NBA level. And so, you know, the fact that he's making those adjustments early this season is very encouraging, because he doesn't have to make those adjustments in a way that he would have to in year one in the NBA. So the fact that he's getting a head start is very encouraging.
Yeah, it's a great just setting for him to work on these kind of tertiary skills, and more importantly, that confidence, and build that up to be like, oh, like I had a solid year shooting, and turn that into, no, I'm a shooter. I'm a legit NBA level off ball scorer and off ball creator. And that's what he's doing in this current setting with Colorado State. And at the Open, we kind of talked about there. I mentioned that I was a little surprised that he not only returned, but also didn't transfer up. And if he did that, he's probably back in that same spot up only, play awesome defense role that he was mainly in last year, and not kind of given the freedom or even just the opportunity to explore and build on some of these really tangible skill improvements that he's showing every single game so far.
So let's talk about the shift in tendencies. And again, because the sample size is now a relevant 4 as opposed to a completely irrelevant 3, those numbers are going to be different if you, you know, look at them right now. But I think the trends are really the important part to hit. And it's not like that last game against Ole Miss particularly screwed with sort of the trends.
Which he was very good in, by the way.
Yes. No, I watched that game back before we recorded specifically for that purpose. And Matthew Morrell is someone who I've been high on many times in the past, and he's had a rough start to the year offensively, but defensively, you know, he's leading the SEC in steals, right? He's, you know, still up there with some of the best defenders. And, you know, for that to be an early season matchup for Neek to face and do very well against that, that tells me a lot more than, you know, to pull an example, say his game against North Dakota, right? Like that's a much higher level of, you know, it's asinine to say, but it's important to say it's a much higher level of competition when you're not only facing a better team in Ole Miss, but a team that has, you know, a borderline NBA level sort of 3 and D wing themselves in Morrell.
Yeah, and you know, the tricky part with these mid-major role players is that it's like, all right, like you're a good role player at a mid-major, but how, like a mid-major role player is very different than like a power four role player. They're when you have guys who aren't playing or who are in the mid-major kind of competition, you hope that they take over games a little more consistently. And Neek's doing that as an off-ball wing. But when you face that higher competition, you have to prove that it translates, that it's that your effectiveness is the same, that your approach is the same, that your processing and your confidence is the same, if not better. And that's exactly what he did in that Ole Miss game, where Colorado State got blown out.
Oh, yeah. They were down, like, 20 and a half?
Something like that. I think they ended up losing by, like, 30 or 25 or something. But if you just watched him, you wouldn't know, because he was so comfortable. He looked really confident out there. His decision-making was fantastic. And no matter who they kind of threw at him or how uncomfortable they tried to make him, he just made the right play every single time. And it's a testament to his maturity and his IQ and just how much slower the game has gotten for him as he's kind of built up his handling, his floor awareness, and his passing accuracy.
So, again, you know, the numbers in the piece are going to be ever so slightly out of date, but just sort of the general trends of what's happening, right? You know, as you mentioned earlier, he's still spotting up more than anything else, but slightly less. He's shooting slightly fewer shots off the catch and slightly more sort of self-created looks. But, you know, as you mentioned, really the biggest difference is how much he's been playing in pick and roll and how well he's been doing at playing in pick and roll.
Yeah, and currently he's in the 93rd percentile in pick and roll ball handler scoring. It's his second most common play type. When we include his passes, he's in the 90th percentile. And that's what I've really enjoyed, is that the way that he's kind of snaking through the defense, getting to the rim, finishing with power, finishing with different angles, knocking down elbow jumpers, and then the passing has been so incredibly good. And it's not just like two-man game passing where he's, you know, making pocket passes and just kind of reading that first level of the defense. He's reading the entire floor and constantly making skip passes, drawing in help side rotations, and then kicking it out to opposite side corner shooters. And all of that is coming from these pick and roll reps that he's getting. The important thing, though, is, like, again, to put it into the proper context of who he'll be as an NBA guy. And it's all of this isn't to say that he's going to be constantly running the pick and roll in the NBA, but 10 seconds of the shot clock and, you know, his big is at the elbow, picks up his dribble and needs to hand it off. And they go into a makeshift pick and roll DHO right off the bat and quick decision needs to be made. Shot clock's running down. Clifford's going to be able to, or is looking like he's going to be able to jump right in there, get that feed and either, you know, make that pocket pass, skip it out, or kind of get to his own shot in the mid-range or at the rim. And having that ability to keep the defense on their heels because they don't know what you're going to do, because you're constantly showing that you can basically do whatever you want, is really important. Because, you know, if the scouting report is, hey, when he comes off a screen, he's just going to the rim. Like, all right, cool, we're going under everything. But now he's, you know, throwing a jab step in there, sending the defender under, and then stepping back and knocking down a pull-up three. That makes it a lot harder. Now you incorporate the passing as well. And it's like, oh my God, like you are not supposed to be anywhere in the defensive scouting report because you're this seventh, eighth option. And now there are a handful of minutes every game where you're kind of taking over and creating for other people and making life hell for whoever we're trying to hide on you. It can really swing a game in those kind of second quarter minutes.
And, you know, this is something we talked a lot back in the day with two players who, on the one hand, are extraordinarily different from Neek. And on the other hand, the sort of fundamental lesson, I think, is the same of, you know, I remember how we used to talk all the time about Devin Booker and Zach LaVine mm-hmm. getting all these on-ball reps, growing yeah. as passers, growing as playmakers, because, you know, the Suns and Timberwolves, respectively, were just like, here's the ball, make something happen, right? And that's the kind of thing where, you know, because Neek is not, you know, an all-star level, you know, ridiculous dunk contest athlete, any number of things that you could list off positively about Zach LaVine and Devin Booker that isn't quite where Neek is at, right? You know, especially because those Suns and Timberwolves teams were not the best. Let's be kind and say not the best. You know, they could afford to, you know, give Booker and LaVine the ball and say, all right, figure it out, right? For mm-hmm. Neek to be doing that this year in college is, you know, very much more helpful and relevant to his NBA context, because he's not going to get 2 years to figure it out, right? Yeah. He's going to get this year. And then, especially since he's a fifth-year senior, next year he better be ready to go right away. And so, you know, again, it's what we talked about earlier, right? Of, okay, you know, if he were just a defensive piece, if he were just a shooter who can't attack a closeout, then it's a lot, you know, even if you're the seventh, eighth, ninth line on the scouting report, right? If the scouting report is a one line thing, right? You know, you mentioned sort of abandoning Isaac Okoro earlier, right? I mean, for me, the example that always stands out was Rajon Rondo shot 37% from 3-point range in one of his years with Sacramento. And there was not a single one of those attempts where there was a defender within like 15 feet of him, right? It was like, yeah, okay, go for it. Sure. We don't care. Like, the damage you're going to do to us is passing. We don't care if you shoot, right? For someone like Neek, you have to at least have sort of, again, this goes back to the Troy Daniels thing. You have to at least have sort of a baseline level of competence with all of those things if you're going to be a role-playing 3-and-D type. And so for Neek to get those reps this year, you know, maybe it's not what he's going to be doing often at the next level, but just having any sort of experience with that is incredibly helpful in terms of, again, as you mentioned earlier, the confidence, right? Of, okay, I know what I'm going to do when the ball hits my hands, and it's going to be something that is a positive for the team, right? Whether it's just going up with it right away, whether it's, you know, pump faking, driving, kicking out, any of those sorts of combinations of things, getting that sort of baseline level of competence is really the most important thing with Clifford. I mean, I talked about this with Daron Holmes' shot last year, and I'll bring him up because I love talking about Daron Holmes and I won't get to see him play for a while. It makes me sad. But, you know, the idea of what does he need to do? He doesn't need to be Steph Curry, right? He just needs to be able to hit a standstill trail three. And over the course of his 3 years at Dayton, he went from 1 of 7 from 3-point range to 31% on like one attempt per game, something like that, to last year, 38% at 2.5 attempts per game, and the kind of attempts that he will be taking in an NBA context, as opposed to just, oh, well, there's no one within 15 feet of me, I guess I might shoot, right? And the pick and roll reps for Neek Clifford are the same sort of deal. You know, is he going to be a Trae Young level of passer? No, but he doesn't need to be. He just needs to be useful in the couple of times a game where he's at the 3-point line and the defender closes and he can, you know, pump fake, get him to blow by, right? That's really all it is, just the baseline level of competence at that sort of play.
Yeah, and something I think you said that is so important in that is that he's having the opportunity, or if in the NBA, he doesn't have years to figure this kind of stuff out, because he is an upperclassman, he is an older guy, and he is a role player, and the margin for error is minuscule. Like, a lot of guys, you get like 3 opportunities early in a year, and if you can't convince the coaching staff in very limited minutes, so it's like, hey, I'm not a total negative out there, give me 2 more minutes next month, it can swing a career, because coaches aren't patient. They're not going to be like, they're not going to hold your hand. They're going to expect you to figure it out right away. And a couple of guys that I kind of keep going to for, you know, loose comps with Clifford is Christian Brown and Aaron Wiggins, and those aren't franchise altering players necessarily, but they've turned into really valuable role players who do a lot of the dirty things that no one else wants to do. They do them at a really high level, and they're continuing to add on to and build on their offensive versatility. Now, Christian Brown, freshman year at Kansas, was a really good spot up shooter. I think he was over 40%. Don't remember the volume, doesn't matter, but the percentages were really good. Returns for a sophomore year, percentages plummet. He becomes really ineffective. It's like, oh my God, what happened to this player? And then you watch the tape, and it's like, oh, the defense is just running him off the line, and he has no idea what to do. And he was horrible. And returns for his junior year, works on those things, and figures out how to attack a closeout, how to use his awesome athleticism to, you know, put guys on posters and make those skip passes out of drives after attacking the closeout. And that's exactly what Neek is doing this year. And by building on those kind of complementary skills in this kind of setting, it's very easy to kind of show, or to take that tape, show it to a coaching staff and be like, hey, just kind of plug and play. This is what I can do for you. Like, my role doesn't have to be changed. It doesn't have to be elevated. It doesn't have to be decreased necessarily. But it's like, I can do this stuff really consistently, really effectively every single night in however many minutes you give me. So when that ball swings to me, I'm not going to be a deer in headlights. I'm going to make the right read. And whether you want me to just let it fly every time it swings to me, cool. done. If you, and once the defense starts attacking me and kind of respecting me as a spot up shooter, cool. Now I'm elevating the play of everyone else around me by finding those open pockets and making that extra pass.
And it's funny that you bring up Christian Brown. I was extremely wrong about Christian Brown. Very, very wrong. And, you know, you have to be able to own your mistakes to be able to do this draft thing properly at all, right? But with Brown, I think a lot of my hesitation was how real is the shooting? And, mm-hmm. you know, as it turned out, I was like, well, he does everything else well enough that it's, you know, something that can come along more slowly. And, you know, this year he's hitting 45% on three of them a game. And it's like, yeah, that'll play, right? But, you know, I think part of the sort of argument for someone like Christian Brown is, you know, he ended up being, he was the 21st pick in that draft, goes mm-hmm. to Denver, right? If he's a early second round pick going to a terrible team instead of ending up on, you know, a team that literally won the championship his rookie year in the Denver Nuggets, do we look at his career differently? And I would be stunned if we didn't. You know, that was basically the best possible situation that he could have ended up in. And to his credit, he maximized it. And now he's a starter in year three, right? So, you know, clearly that worked out well for him. But it's interesting because, you know, when you're sort of talking about the shooting being the swing skill, the fact that he was, you know, I think he was 35%. I had the number up a second ago, but, you know, in the mid 30s from 3-point range, his mm-hmm. rookie year, he just did everything else at a high enough level. I could see that being the path for Neek, right? Of, okay, you know, maybe I think the odds of him being, you know, a 47%, 50% 3-point shooter are pretty slim, right? But if he gets to the point where, and, you know, this gets into some of the defense stuff we'll go to in a moment here, right? But it's like he, you know, with the sort of playmaking stuff, he needs to be at sort of a baseline level. With the shooting, I think it's more sort of important for his ability to stay on the floor. But that's one of those things where, you know, if he gets to a point where it's everything but the shot, you get time to figure out the shot. If you have other issues, that's going to be excuses for coaches not to play you. And this is actually, I think, a good way to transition into talking about the defense, because, I mean, that's probably where he earns his way onto the court, right?
Yes.
Like, that's, you know, he's going to get played because of his defensive acumen. And then, you know, the sort of question there becomes, can he do enough else? And, you know, certainly having had the joy of watching Keon Ellis the last couple of years, if you're that level of crazy defender, and mm-hmm. Neek isn't disruptive in the way that Keon is. Not to say that Neek isn't disruptive, but few people alive are defensively disruptive the right. way that Keon Ellis is. But, you know, again, it's one of those things where, you know, Keon shot 40% from three last year on pretty slim volume, and he was barely shooting at all. You know, he was basically out there to knock down open threes and not do much else. But he earned his way onto the court with the defense, and then it was like, can you do enough else? And I would argue he's done more than enough else, especially after his 33-point performance last night. But if that's sort of the baseline with this kind of player, what you're looking at is, can you do enough offensively to let your defense shine? And defense is your thing more than anybody I know. So, yeah, I'm more than happy to let you run wild in just a minute here. But I think that's sort of the key point to capture with Neek, is all of this offensive stuff that we spent the last half hour talking about is sort of, all right, make sure that you're not a zero on the mm-hmm. other end, because offense is the other end for Neek Clifford.
Ready to level up? Chumba Casino is your playbook to fun. It's free to play with no purchase necessary. Enjoy hundreds of online social games like blackjack, slots, and solitaire anytime, anywhere with fresh releases every week. Whether you're at home or on the go, let Chumba Casino bring the excitement to you. Plus, get free daily login bonuses and a free welcome bonus. Join now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Play Chumba Casino today. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. T&Cs apply.
I'm Serena Williams, and I'm healthier on Row. I've lost 34 pounds in a year with GLP-1s, diet, and exercise. On Row, you can access GLP-1 options, including the first FDA-approved GLP-1 pill for weight loss. Go to row.co/journey to see if you qualify. 14 to 20% average weight loss in 1 year in non-diabetics with obesity or overweight with a weight-related medical condition versus 2.2% to 3.1% in placebo arm. RX only. To stay informed about serious side effects, go to row.co/safety.
Right. And just looking at, you know, the current standings right now, and like some of the teams not picking in the lottery, just offensively, you know, I'll move on to the defense in a quick second. But when we talk about why these kind of tangential skills are so important for that Neek is showing this year, and Indiana, Minnesota, Miami, OKC, Memphis, Orlando, Houston, Golden State, Boston, like Cleveland, so many of these teams, it's dribble drive, kick out, attack again. It's high ball movement, high feel, high decision making with that positional size. And that's, if Neek didn't have any of those skills that he's showing this year, he doesn't last a second in what, half of the league's offenses.
Yeah.
It's tough. But then you talk about, and obviously we just spent 40 minutes talking about those skills improving, but then you add in the defense too, with his size, his strength, his length, his physicality, his footwork, his fundamentals, his awareness, the rotations.
Hold on. 39 minutes in, and that's the first time you said the word footwork?
Yeah, I know.
Where is Tyler Metcalf? What did you do with him?
Here I am talking about offense. Gross. But it's the defense is ready-made. And the fact that the offense is rapidly getting there as well, again, in a role player standpoint and a role player context, that's really crucial. And, you know, you talk about Keon Ellis kind of getting his opportunity on that end through that with the Timberwolves, Nikhil Alexander-Walker basically doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Not the same defender necessarily as Clifford is. But coaches like defense. Coaches hate players who they cannot trust on the defensive end unless they're an all-NBA type of guy. So if you're going to be a role player and not defend, you better be a lethal shooter or scorer or something. But the clearest route to that is the defensive end, which for Clifford, I don't think anyone really has any questions about.
And you mentioned the Orlando Magic earlier, so that's my excuse to shoehorn the discussion in the direction that I want to take it, which is, if I think it's hard for me to think of a better example of this phenomenon than Jalen Suggs, who, you know, again, I was much higher on his sort of offensive potential coming into the NBA, but his first season in Orlando, he was brutal offensively. 36% from the floor, 21% from three-point range. You know, had a positive assist to turnover ratio, but, you know, still turned the ball over three times a game, three fouls a game, like rough stuff offensively. And if he had not, you know, sort of focused all, you know, not all, that's going too far, but if he had not focused so heavily and extensively on his play on the defensive end, he might be out of the league right now. Instead, he just made his way onto an all-defensive team and signed a 5-year, $150 million contract extension, right? And that's, you know, we're talking about someone in Suggs who was, you know, the fifth pick in the draft, right? If that's something that can happen to the fifth pick in the draft, you can bet that it's going to happen to a guy who's coming into the league at 23 as opposed to 19 and, you know, is going to be, you know, I think we both think probably somewhere late first round, early second, but certainly not fifth overall, right? You get a lot more leeway when you're fifth overall. And even still, Suggs, you know, lost his starting job in year two and had to earn it back with his defense in year three.
Yeah. And when we talk about late first round, those teams are either someone who's trading up or dependent. Well, I know if you look at Tankathon this year, it's just everything's traded.
Yeah. This year is not a good year for that example, but I think I get where you're going.
Theoretically,
yes.
It's a contender. It's someone who has a missing piece, who needs something, who needs the glue to just kind of hold everything together. And a lot of the times what that means is we need an eighth guy in the rotation. We have six, we might have seven, but God, we do not have eight. And Clifford could be that eight, or even nine in the regular season to, you know, eat up minutes. But that's the type of thing where it's like, all right, hey, we need a wing defender and someone who is just a nice complement on the offensive end who is available 25 on. And it's like, okay, here's an incredible option. Are there going to be sexier home run swing lottery ticket type guys? Of course. But their floors are going to be so much lower than I feel really comfortable kind of assuming that Nick Clifford is going to just give a team solid minutes in his rookie year. And then that, given the skill improvement and the shooting improvement that we've seen with him over the last 2 to 3 years, why does that have to stop? Why isn't there still more room for him to continue to grow while he earns more and more minutes on the defensive end?
And this is something I know we've talked about before, but is, you know, essentially the point that you just brought up of why over the years I've become more and more convinced that the player you want to take in the 20s is the upperclassman who you're confident in the floor. Because it's exactly what you just said, right? Either you're a contending team who just needs one more piece, or you're a team trading up because you think this guy can make a serious difference in our rotation, you know, and it's one of those things where, you know, sometimes again, you know, with the Christian Brown example, his career probably looks a lot different and almost certainly worse if he ends up somewhere other than Denver. The flip side of that is, you know, Jonathan Mobo goes to the Toronto Raptors with the first pick of the second round and becomes a rotation player immediately and, you know, is a stellar defensive piece immediately. And yeah, the shot's not there, but, you know, if you followed him in college at all, you knew the shot wasn't there, right? But, right, you know, the fact that he's averaging 2.3 offensive rebounds a game in 15 minutes, you know, that tells the whole story of, okay, Toronto looked at Mobo and they said, wow, this guy can fill a lot of gaps for us. It's essentially the same logic, except a much worse team, you know, and there are bad teams that could use, you know, another guy to sort of bind things together. But really the teams, you know, and again, we're, this year's a bit different, but theoretically, generally, as you mentioned, right, the idea is if you're picking in the 20s, you don't need a second superstar, or, you know, something is very weird with your team if you're picking in that contender range and you need a second superstar. What you need more than anything is, can this guy be a rotation player for us sooner rather than later? And, you know, if you're, the example that I always go back to is Jay Crowder, because like this guy had a decade long NBA career after being the ACC player of the year because he was drafted at like 22, 23. And there are, you know, because he was the 34th pick, there are a lot of guys taken ahead of him who did not last 11 years in the NBA. And, you know, the example, Draymond Green's favorite example certainly is the fact that Draymond Green went 35th, right? But, you know, again, that's one of those things. He earned his way onto the court with his defense, and also because David Lee was injured, and then things sort of went from there, right? If you're going to a really good team that just needs one more piece, if you have the sort of diverse skill set that Nick Clifford is building and your calling card, which in his case is one that coaches tend to love in being good defensively, you have a lot more opportunity to show that you can round out the rest of your game than, you know, if you are someone who's just brought in and, you know, okay, like, you know, this is, I don't want to be mean, so I'm not going to go with James Wiseman, but that sort of idea of a team drafts a guy based, you know, purely on potential and they don't ever get the developmental minutes they need. And all of a sudden you get 5 years down the line and, you know, Wiseman just tours ACL on, is it his third team, his fourth team, you know, something like that, right? If you need the developmental minutes and you don't get them, your career can go south in a hurry. On the flip side, if you're already this sort of solidified player with this balanced skill set, there are many different paths to rotation, right? There could be a team, you know, like if Nick Clifford goes to Cleveland, he's exclusively a 1-2. If he goes to this version of OKC with both bigs out, he might be a 4, right? Who knows? Right. But if you have that sort of diverse skill set where, okay, here's gap X, gap Y, gap Z, the fact that he's averaging 11 rebounds a game, right, is like, okay, you know, that's something where he can really help us out in a way that, you know, maybe one, you know, a certain team doesn't need that kind of help at all. But for the team that does, it's very valuable to have someone with that kind of skill set on the floor.
Yeah, and that just kind of leads into, you know, just a bigger overarching issue of the issues with individual big boards, because they're vastly different for every team. Like, I have Nick Clifford around like 20 or something right now, but, you know, for like Utah or Brooklyn, it might be, he might be lower than that. Whereas, you know, Minnesota or Denver or OKC or something, you know, someone like that, he might be even higher because the foundation's there. You know, they just kind of need some of the accessories to fill out the house, and that Nick Clifford could be a hell of an accessory. But, you know, he goes to Brooklyn and it's like, what's the plan? Like, what are we doing here? because he's not an offensive creator. He's not an offensive engine. He needs, in an NBA context, he needs someone alongside him to do that stuff while he does the rest of the crap that no one else wants to do. Exactly. And if he goes to a team without that guy, then it's like, this might be more of a slog. But, you know, that's kind of why I always like the idea of doing like a post draft ranking of like, oh, I really like that landing spot for this guy, and I think his outcome is a lot more favorable now than maybe a week ago.
Yeah, and you know, I mentioned this with Christian Brown, right? I was wrong about him. I was much lower than I should have been, but he goes to Denver and it's like, oh, of course. Like, you know, Peyton Watson, same deal, right? Of mm-hmm. like, oh no, this could be very bad if he goes to the wrong situation. Oh, he went to the best possible situation. I think Peyton Watson's going to be just fine. And, you know, sure enough, he worked out a lot better than your average 30th overall pick because he went to a situation where his weaknesses could be minimized by the other players on the floor and his strengths could be maximized, right? And, you know, with Neek, yeah, I mean, if the Kings had a first round pick, I would love to have him on the Kings, even though, you know, I have him more in sort of the early second round range because, God, do they need defensive wings, right? And so, okay.
Most teams do.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the teams, again, you know, even when we're talking about bad teams, right? Like, this isn't true for Utah, but, like, pretty much every bad team has at least one player that is sort of a foundational offensive piece, right? It's like, you know, if we're talking about Utah and Washington, maybe not, but even Washington, right? Bilal Coulibaly's had a fantastic year too. Certainly seems like
Bob looks really encouraging.
Yeah. All of that, right? It's like, okay.
But even still most a lot of wild cards.
Yes. But the point I'm trying to get at is even most of the bad teams will have an offensive engine that Neek or someone in a similar archetype could play off, right? But, you know, it's a lot easier to sort of imagine him, you know, again, okay, could he be the ninth man for the Timberwolves? Could he be the ninth man for the Kings? Yes and yes. Would he, you know, be able to enter Steve Kerr's rotation in Golden State? Absolutely. Would things, as you mentioned, look slightly different in Brooklyn? Probably. Would it maybe not be, well, that's a different story because they could use anybody who could shoot, but like, would it look slightly different in Chicago? Yeah, probably wouldn't be as clean of a sort of fit, but that's the sort of thing that you're looking at when you're talking about a player with Neek's profile. You know, he's not going to be the mystery box because he's already, you know, he's already a fifth year senior, right? He's going to need to be at a level where he can be plugged in pretty much right away. And the more he diversifies his skill set offensively, the easier it is to see the path toward him doing that.
Yeah. And he's just continuing to show and improve on all of those complementary skills that make life easier for superstars. So I think he's going to be one of these guys that, they'll probably get overthought come draft time. It's like, he's older. He's not a sharp shooter. And it's then, you know, come February of next year, he could very easily be a guy of like, oh my God, how did Miami get this guy at 22? How did the league let Clifford fall to the Nuggets or Classic Thunder getting another one of these guys? And because he's got really good feel, he's got a ton of defensive versatility, and the offensive game continues to improve a ton every single year.
All right. Anything else you want to cover before we wrap this one up?
No. Neek Clifford's fun. Go watch him.
Perfect. We're not going to find a much better way to end than that. All right. He is Tyler Metcalf. You can find his work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find him on Twitter at TMetcalf11. And what's your Blue Sky handle again? I don't remember it off the top of my head.
I think it's like just Tyler Metcalf.
If you search up the name Tyler Metcalf and see a dude who has an orange avatar, you'll find him. Yes, there you go.
Yeah. I'm somewhere on there.
Yeah. I'm also somewhere on there. You can find me on Blue Sky at nbajohnson.bluesky.social. And you can, I probably won't go on Twitter much anymore, but you know, you can still find me there at nbajohnson for now. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to subscribe and leave a rating and or a review wherever you listen to your podcast. That's always much appreciated on our end. You can, of course, find No Ceilings on all social media at No Ceilings NBA, No Ceilings TV on YouTube. And if you've been enjoying the deep dives portion of the show and have any feedback or have any feedback, as I should say, feel free to reach out to me either via Twitter /Blue Sky or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening. Thank you.